Hi, welcome to this week's program. You know, spring is here and maybe you're out looking for a new car. David Mulbaum, Kiplinger's resident car expert, joins me to help you find that perfect car at the best price.
The dealership is not always going to tell you about it. It's up to you to find out what those incentives are.
And what makes a successful investor? It's a combination of knowledge and insight and temperament. And you'll hear all about it in my in-depth two-part interview with investing great Monish Pabrai. As he says, it's simple, but it's not easy.
Ignore the noise, you know, ignore the ups and downs, and you'll come out okay on the other end.
Also, are we witnessing the death of the retail mall in America? I take a good look at this in my commentary this week. And of course, we have Terry's story in our real estate roundup segment and so much more. So stay tuned. Here we go. According to a U.S. Census Bureau's trade report, 2016 was a good year for the retail and food services sector. Spending was up a little over 3% annually to $5.5 trillion, and the all-important holiday season from October to December, sales were up 4% relative to the prior year. Moreover, the gross domestic product has been inching up over the past 8 years as the environment of low gas prices, low unemployment, some wage growth has been putting more money in our pockets. This should be good news for retail, right? Well, yes and no. When we dug a little deeper, we found that Christmas spending at brick-and-mortar stores was down about 2%, while online spending was up a sizable 12.8%. So clearly, traditional store-based retailers didn't have a good 2016, while online retailers such as Amazon did. Now, this is not a surprise. This is not news to anyone, because we all notice the closure signs in our neighborhood malls and read about stores like one of America's most iconic retailers, Macy's, announcing plans to close 168 stores due to declining traffic. Sears announced plans to close 108 Kmart and 42 Sears stores to stem losses, and a spate of retail closure announcements and bankruptcies from JCPenney and Radio Shack, Sports Authority, Payless, American Eagle, and more have hit the headlines. So what's really behind this retail meltdown, especially given the fact that retail in the economy is growing healthily? It's multiple factors, but they're not all as obvious as you would expect. First, the ones we all know. The internet has reached a point of technological and cultural maturity. Online technology, mobile apps, payment systems, product choice, e-commerce security, and the convenience of next-day home delivery have clearly evolved to the point where consumers no longer feel they need to walk into a store to get what they want. In parallel, consumers are now comfortable with online shopping and their mobile apps, and they trust the safety and security of online payments. And we are delighted by delivery and return options and the convenience and substantial time and gas savings that come from buying online. Not to mention the fact that it's just a lot of fun to get stuff in the mail. As a result, online retailers are cashing in. For example, Amazon has seen sales quintuple from $16 billion in 2010 to $80 billion in 2016. But the story is clearly bigger than Amazon, as many smaller specialty online retailers are also cashing in. Now, in addition, and these are the stories you're not hearing about, and it's really what made me think about this topic today. Retailers have simply overbuilt. For the past 45 years, America added malls at 2 times the rate of its population growth. As a result, per capita, America has 40% more retail shopping space than Canada, 500% more than Britain, and 1,000% more than Germany. And this has been a big contributor to the retail crash we are now witnessing. All of this was dramatically accelerated by the recession in 2007, where millions lost their jobs, then tightened their spending, and then became alert bargain hunters. Meanwhile, technology hit its sweet spot at exactly the same time. To top it all, there was that demographic shift that I have long talked about. The rise of tech-savvy millennials that embraced e-commerce with open arms and basically upended traditional retail, corporate, and social structures. The deeply impactful attitudes of this generation lay greater emphasis on spending time with friends and family and valuing experiences and social causes more than spending money on branded goods or wasteful purchases. So, branded clothing stores saw a sharp decline in sales, while travel and local dining services gained. And we can see this when we look at the data from American air carriers, which are setting passenger records, and note that restaurant and bar spending grew at twice the pace of all other retail spending. So, the big question, is this the end of America's mall culture? Not quite. While a lot of excess retail space could turn into ghost buildings or be torn down, malls in demographically vibrant areas will see a shift in their usage. They'll go from dedicated shopping centers like they are now to vibrant community centers that embrace society and its new set of values. These will be mixed-use developments where people live, shop, see their doctor, work, socialize, and skip the long commute, where little urban villages replace the old mall suburbia model and bring new life to dying areas, a new spring, if you will. For example, Lifetime Fitness, the developers of high-end fitness centers, is planning to expand into the large box stores left empty by the exit of large retailers. They're also planning to help take advantage of the new configuration of the mall experience to be more of a village-type center surrounded by restaurants, medical centers, small retail, and more. So let's ask the investment question. Is this a good time to buy battered retail stocks, much like in November of 2008 when banking stocks took such a lashing? Well, again, yes and no. Undoubtedly, some brick-and-mortar retailers are going to come out of this leaner and stronger with new online strategies, but I fear that many others will resort to desperate strategies like acquiring their competitors for too much money, which in the end will only delay their demise. It looks like things could get a lot worse before they get better, and we'll continue to see significant store closings in the next few years. So, investment-wise, unless you know the retail sector really well and willing and able to pore over a lot of accounting statements, I'd say don't sift for bargains in the brick-and-mortar retail sinking sands. Sit this one out and park your money elsewhere for now. And while you're looking, see if you can spot a few undervalued niche online plays that are well-positioned to deliver solid future returns. After all, that is what really is driving the growth. This week on the On the Money Minute, allocating your assets during retirement. Hi, this is Steve Pomerantz with today's On the Money Minute. Surprisingly, few new retirees or pre-retirees have a plan for allocating their assets once they hit retirement. However, if your portfolio is going to be a source of your financial security during retirement, then it has to be carefully looked at so it can provide the income you need during retirement. Apart from the obvious benefit, there are a number of factors that reinforce the necessity for continued portfolio growth. First of all, inflation erodes assets. This makes it necessary for you to lower your standard of living. Not a happy thought. That means you might be forced to make withdrawals at a percentage rate that is higher than your portfolio is actually earning. This substantially shortens the life of your portfolio. Remember, your goal is to make your assets last as long as you do or longer. More tomorrow on this. I'm Steve Pomerantz. To hear more on the Money Minutes, plus Steve's weekly radio show, go to stevepomerantz.com. This is another segment in our Great Investor Series, and I'm very happy to welcome back Monish Prabhai as my guest today. Monish began his investing career in 1999 after he sold his business, and then he discovered and studied the work of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. And by his own admission, he says he's been pilfering their ideas ever since. Monish and his good friend Guy Spier got to sit down with Buffett for an afternoon with Warren Buffett after winning the charity lunch in 2007. And finally, to add to Monish's cred as a manager, his investment fund has crushed the return of the S&P 500 by over 1,100% in the past 16 to 17 years. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Monish.
Well, Steve, it's great to be back, and I love your show.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, it's great to see you at the Berkshire Conference in May, although we have to get up pretty ridiculously early to get some decent seats. What did you think of the conference?
Well, this year actually was my 20th year attending, and I've been every year, so it was 20 years in a row. And every year, you know, even though I think that, you know, kind of the scripture and Bible, if you will, is known well, every year I find myself learning something. And also then the second bigger purpose the meeting serves is just reinforcing core principles. And so this was great. This is another great year of having that.
Yeah. Was there anything that pops out as particularly special or different this year for you?
Well, I very much enjoyed the discussion they had around Google.
Oh, yeah.
And Amazon, and also the discussion around the top four market cap stocks in the U.S., which are Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. And those four make up nearly something like 10% of the total market cap of all U.S. stocks, if you will.
Well, that has implications in itself, right?
That's right. And quite frankly, it's from the way these companies are going and doing, it may not be that any of them are in bubble-esque territory.
Really? Because they're growing so fast.
Well, they have very dominant positions and they have very robust cash flows. And in some cases, like Apple, they're at a very modest multiple.
Yeah. And with all that cash and all of that influence, they can really push their way around and kind of own the industry. And that's kind of a moat, you know, this idea of having some kind of protection or business protection around you. Would you say that those companies, I mean, we're talking about technology companies here, actually have a strong protective moat around them?
Yeah, I mean, I think normally tech businesses, you know, you can say they're kind of subject to disruptive innovation, but these are companies which are really kind of part of let's say, habit changes in humans. So, you know, when we buy things at Amazon or when we search for things on Google, and, you know, just the Apple TV and me buying, you know, movies on Apple TV and such, you know, those are more consumer type businesses where the brands and the habit formations that take place amongst consumers can be far more resilient than the underlying technology. And so I think that gives these businesses some legs versus just a pure tech business.
What really fascinated me was his admission and his regret of not having invested in Amazon. I mean, as investors, I think every investor has some regrets. No matter how small the investor you are, the big one you missed, the big fish that got away. But to hear someone like Buffett, who's accumulated and amassed so much wealth, to have such strong regrets about misunderstanding Jeff Bezos and the kind of talent that he had, and in a sense, missing Amazon as an investment, I thought that really struck me very oddly.
Yeah, and also I think he wasn't so much in agony about Amazon as he was about Google, because he said that the Google guys actually both came to see him before the IPO.
Yeah.
And they wanted help in, they actually wanted to plagiarize some of his owner's manual and letters to partners and so on. And even before the IPO, Berkshire, through Geico, was a big customer of Google with AdWords and such. So Berkshire could see very clearly the power of that model, and he was very aware of it, and Charlie Munger was very aware of it. And so the economics of that were very apparent to them, and they had a private audience with the founders and such. So all the data that they wanted was available to them. And that one, I think he regrets more. I think Amazon is a difficult one for most of us because the multiple always looks so high.
Yeah, because they not hide their earnings, but they reinvest their earnings.
That's right.
So you don't really see any return. Okay, so let me switch gears here. You know, I'm an investment advisor, and I would say that practically everybody who comes into my office is nervous about their stock investments. You know, although the market is hitting new highs, the general feeling is that somehow this isn't real, that it's all just smoke and mirrors, and it's going to come tumbling down any minute. What are your thoughts about where we are in the stock market? Is it justified? Are these higher prices justified?
Well, I mean, I think when I look at the U.S. market, I would say that I don't see it as being overpriced, but it's possibly fully priced. And the only caveat there is that if our low interest rates persist for some extended period, then markets would actually currently be underpriced.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really hard to know kind of where interest rates are 5 years from now or 10 years from now. But if we could know that interest rates 5 years from now will be similar to where they are today or 10 years from now, then stocks are a bargain. And so I think the best advice is that it is not a bad thing to own fractions of great U.S. businesses, and it's not a bad thing to own them through some type of broad index fund with low costs and such. And the key thing is to not panic when markets go down. But, you know, if you're in your 30s, 40s, or 50s, you know, and your dollar cost averaging some small portion of your income, that's a great way to go.
Well, I think Charlie Munger said that really the best way to become rich is to spend less than you earn, save the difference, put it in index funds, and just kind of keep dollar cost averaging year after year. And after 20, 30, 40 years, it's inevitable that you will be rich. Do you subscribe to that?
Yeah, and how simple is that?
I know.
And then the reality is we end up with very few people who are actually rich.
Yeah.
And lots of people who, over their lifetime, have had tremendous earnings.
Yeah.
Because these simple rules won't get followed. Something that's simple is not always easy.
Well, this is the thing. You know, it's one thing to say that the best bargains or the best buys are available when the markets are in their worst periods. But it's a psychological characteristic to be able to buy when the whole world is telling you to sell. How does a good manager, how does a person counteract those natural feelings?
Well, I think the best way to do that is to not overthink it, put it on autopilot, you know, max your 401k with the employer match. If that's not there, then max the amount that can go into your IRAs and such, and whatever you can save after tax. And then just have a automated system where your savings keep going into one, two, or three broad indices, and ignore the noise, you know, ignore the ups and downs, and you'll come out okay on the other end.
Yeah, yeah. My guest is Monish Prabhai. As I said, he's a hedge fund manager who has a proven track record of really trouncing the S&P 500. And basically, Monish, you came out of selling a business successfully, reinvesting that money and losing a lot of money in the next business. And then you came out and said, you know what? Let me do it like Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger does it. Stay tuned for part two of my interview with Monish Prabhai later in the show. Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. David Mulbaum is Kiplinger's resident car expert, and since spring is here, I thought it would be a good time to help you sharpen your skills to get the best deal on a car. Hey, David, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
You know, the internet has disrupted a lot of industries, but it hasn't really affected the new car buying process. Do you still have to haggle with the salesman to get your best deal?
Yes. If you really want to get the best price, you have to get down there and sit on the other side of the desk, or at least work the phone pretty hard.
Yeah.
But most dealers are still going to want you at the end of the day to show your face.
So I guess the question is, how do you stop the madness? How do you go in prepared? So if you're going to have to haggle, if you're going to have to negotiate, you can do so from a position of strength. What do you do first?
Well, while the internet really has not disrupted the actual closing of a car deal, a new car deal, it has made shopping for new cars much more consumer friendly, if you will, to put more power in the hands of the consumer, because you can find out so much information about not just the car, but the various incentives that might be available to you so that you can negotiate the best price. So knowledge is power, and research is your first step.
So there are sites like Edmunds.com and Kelley Blue Book, and another one you've listed here, True Car.
And Car Jojo is another one I encourage people to check out. It's a relative new entry here, but they really, I find their listing of the available incentives quite helpful.
C-A-R-J-O-J-O?
Yes.
Car Jojo. Cool. All right, so they let you configure a vehicle exactly as you'd want it, and then you can get the price. And then what do you recommend? You kind of look at different prices and you kind of go in with an average price. I guess you're really not trying to get the lowest price per se, definitely not the highest. So how do you price the car when you're going in? What do you think?
It's tremendously difficult, in part because the sites vary to some extent in whether they're promising you what the price would be on a car like this or an actual car. And you're only negotiating about an actual car when a car has a VIN assigned to it, vehicle and identification number.
Yeah.
So you can get a sense of what the prices are, and you can get, in some cases, from such a True Car, roughly what you will pay or what you could pay. But in terms of finding that actual car, you've got to get down to the actual VIN number of the car and go check out with the individual dealerships.
Yeah, so that's important to know. So you go in there, you have got kind of general knowledge, which is good. It's a good place to start from, but it ain't the car. You have to get exactly right down to the all those numbers contained by that VIN number.
Right. In part because when you're configuring a car online, you're imagining as if you were ordering it. But the reality is that dealers, most of the times, people are buying from dealer inventory. And that exact configuration, the way you did it online, may be hard to come by. It's more likely that dealers have purchased for their inventory a certain series of options that they know sell well.
Right. Gotcha. I like this one too. Pinpoint where the industry sweet spots are. You know, for example, you say that crossovers accounted for more than half of the vehicles sold. So if you've got a line of cars that's hot, they're going to basically not give you very good deals on those cars. So you want to look in other areas, right?
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, you want to buy the car that you want, but the car fashion count and do affect the amount of discounts. And it remains the case that the strongest discounts are currently for the relatively slow-selling sedans, and the weakest discounts are for hot sellers. It's, you know, classic supply and demand, and people seem to want crossovers, which, you know, is basically at this point just kind of a car with more ground clearance. That's, you know, supply and demand. People want them. They sell better. The discounts aren't as big.
You also mentioned that car sales are leveling off and projected to slow down. So car makers are going to try to protect their market share. And so you're counseling people to look for prices to soften, and especially from Labor Day to New Year's weekend, as they try to clear the decks for the new models, that may be a good time to buy.
Yes. And we're living in interesting times right now for car pricing in terms of what kind of incentives the manufacturers are offering, because as you mentioned, they are trying to maintain market share and yet not essentially cannibalize themselves by discounting too heavily. So the level of incentives offered is constantly variable. And the other thing to note is that it is regional. So I can't tell you nationally what kind of deals are available to you. You kind of have to go to the sites we discussed, like Edmunds, like sometimes the manufacturers themselves, and see what is available in your area. And you have to know to ask. You know, the dealership is not always going to tell you about it. It's up to you to find out what those incentives are.
That's shocking. That's absolutely shocking that the dealer is not going to tell you about the incentives. My guest is David Mulbaum. He is Kiplinger's resident car expert, and that's what we're talking about today. So instead of buying, what about leasing a car? I mean, I've always leased my own cars. I find that to be right for me. What's the criteria to lease versus buy?
Well, you know, leasing has been growing in popularity. It's roughly a third of cars, new car deals, right? The new car transactions now are leases. This is in part because people want more expensive cars, but then they look at what the payment would be on that expensive car and you can't swing it, so they go with a lease.
Yeah.
Now, leasing, it's not for everyone, but it can be for many people. Basically, if you're in a situation where you always have a car payment, if you're essentially rolling from one loan to the next, you're probably not doing it right, and you should be considering leasing. If, however, you are, you know, kind of person who runs a car for 10 years and loves the feeling of not having a car payment, well, then leasing is not for you.
Absolutely.
But it is clearly a way, you know, the old maxim has been, this is a way to get more car for less payment.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, at the end of the deal, you don't have a car anymore.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, for many people that works. And for people who like to, you know, they're not certain exactly about what car they want, or they like the feel of a new car and they don't want warranty worries, hey, it works.
Also, you have to consider your mileage that you drive. That's pretty important because they come with a 10, 12,000, even 15,000 mileage caps per year. If you go over, you have to pay a certain amount per mile that you actually go over when you turn the car back in. So if you tend to drive long distances, a lease could be out of the question.
Yes. Basically, you know, the car manufacturers, when they're setting up leasing deals, they can move the price point in various ways. One is by cutting the mileage. One is by lowering the cost, the upfront cost, and one is by lowering the monthly payments. In addition to the residual value, leasing gets very complicated very quickly. But yes, you do want to pay attention to the miles. And what I encourage people to do when they're shopping for a lease is to literally make a spreadsheet so that you can work out the cost per mile of the various cars you're looking at.
Right.
And don't forget, even in the lease deal, you have to negotiate the price of the car. Don't just grab onto a monthly payment and say, okay, you have to look at what the total cost of the car is. It's the core to the deal.
What about financing these days? I haven't financed a car in a long time. How is the market for that?
Again, this is a situation where the manufacturer is a big player here because one of the ways they can move cars is by offering a advantageous finance deal. Now, at the same time, you shouldn't consider just what's offered to you at the dealership as the only way to go. You should look for your own financing that might be available to you from, say, a credit union. Good place to start.
Mm-hmm.
But in some cases, remember this, the car dealer is selling you several things. They want to sell you a car. They want to sell you financing. They want to sell you stuff to put on your car. And they want to sell you a lifetime, you know, arrangement of service and future purchases.
Right, right.
That second one, the car financing, is something they're offering for sale. They may be able to mark it up.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the rate they're offering may be better than what you can get outside.
Yeah.
But again, come prepared, know what you can get at your own bank.
Well, I think if the manufacturer is offering the interest rate deal, you're probably in good shape. If the dealer is using standard banks and then marking that up, you're probably not going to be quite as competitive. That's for sure. Also, I'm concerned about taking out a loan that's too long, like a 60-month loan on a car seems to have some issues associated with it, right?
Yeah. I mean, this gets back to some part, the leasing versus buying thing. Are you holding a car long enough that you're holding a car till when, you know, there's no more note on it? Are you free and clear? Because that's its own reward. I mean, cars last a long time. Cars can certainly outrun a 60-month loan with proper care.
Mm-hmm.
But can you think ahead to where you're going to be at that situation? And again, the temptation of the longer loan is to buy a more expensive car. And, you know, from a sort of basic personal finance thing, then you're just taking on a lot of interest costs to pay for something that you maybe shouldn't have been stretching for in the first place.
Yeah, that's what you got to be careful. We only have about a minute left. I noticed in your article, you talked about companies that will do the haggling and the negotiating for you. Some charge a fee, like carbargains.org charges a $250 fee for doing that. And you also mentioned Car Jojo in this as well. Tell us really quickly what that's about.
Well, essentially, if you don't think you have the stomach for negotiating, you can get someone to do it for you. Now, to some extent, some of the larger offerings, like what TrueCar offers, are essentially offering you a upfront price and saying, well, this is roughly what you'll get. But remember that in that situation, those services like TrueCar are getting money back from the dealer for generating a lead. When you essentially pay upfront for a private service negotiating for you, they are negotiating for you. Yeah. So you pay some money upfront to essentially have the stomach to do the deal.
Yeah, interesting. I think that's actually a good way for those that are introverted and just can't stand the fact of spending an afternoon in the dealership fighting, you know, the brave fight. My guest, David Mulbaum, Kiplinger's resident car expert. You can find David at kiplinger.com. His last name is spelled M-U-H-L-B-A-U-M. David, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Find out more about David and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Terry Story and Real Estate Roundup is next.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for a Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
You know, we live in a stressed-out world. I don't even think I need to go into it. All you have to do is read the news. But a study was just recently issued that said Americans are overwhelmed with the stress of moving.
Yeah, you know, the average American would move 6 times throughout their lives, and that's not the case anymore.
Yeah,
they're just not moving. They don't want to move. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was kind of an interesting fact that 65% of all the movers, it's between Memorial Day and Labor Day.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't realize it was that high. I know that that's an active time of year, but I didn't realize it was 65%.
So you know what? You should just take the rest of the year off.
Absolutely. I should only work between those.
You know, it makes 67% of your nut and you're done.
Yeah. Kind of, yeah. I like it. I like the way you think.
Thank you very much. Yeah. So the stress of moving, I know I was talking with my significant other recently. I wanted a more garage space and maybe another room. And she looked at me and said, no, I'm not moving. Yeah. It's too stressful. And so I guess this backs that up, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I can tell you, being in real estate, we're nothing but a punching bag. The stress that the people are experiencing sometimes is vented towards us. And they actually claim that moving is as stressful as dealing with death in families and divorce. So in a lot of ways, I believe it. They're actually saying that it's more stressful than planning a wedding. Now that... I'm not so sure about that. Was very stressful.
Well, honestly, maybe for the woman. I don't know. I never felt that stressed over it, you know.
All right.
I just got in hot water. 5 tips for buyers in a tight housing market. So we know that the market is tight. What are some 5 tips?
Okay. First, determine what your budget is going to be and stick to it. How do you do that? Start off by speaking with a lender, finding out what it's going to actually cost you, factor in taxes, insurance, the total amount. Get that figure, and then from there, figure out the rest of your budget, your food budget, your car allowance, you know, all of your expenses, and stick to it. What's really important to understand in today's market, there's a lot of bidding wars. It's an aggressive market. Know your numbers and stick to them.
Yeah.
So if you know that the most you can go is X amount, then stick to that. You know, have a plan.
Well, especially if you're a realtor, if you say, I want to buy a house for $300,000, your realtor shows you a $400,000 house.
That's a waste of time.
Yeah.
Waste of time. So don't even tease yourself and have the realtor show you a $400,000.
I know it's
house.
A terrible experience because then the $300,000 house. I don't know. I don't like it.
Yeah, I don't like it so much. $400,000. Yeah, and that's in any price range.
Yeah.
So stick to your budget.
Yeah, stick to your budget.
Mm-hmm. Identify neighborhoods and your housing wants versus needs, and you know you can always add the hardwood floors later. You can change out the appliances to stainless steel, but there's certain things that you can't change. If you're looking to be in a specific school district or you're requiring a certain size property, stick to those things. The other things you can change over time. So be prepared. Know the difference between your wants and your needs.
Okay. Number 2. Number 3.
Be ready to make a quick decision. Because the market's so competitive, have all your ducks lined up in a row. Have your money ready. I can't tell you how many times I go to sell a house and the people have their money tied up in the market and it's not liquidated and they need a longer period of time to transfer the funds for escrow, or they're taking it, they're borrowing it against their 401k.
Yeah.
Just make sure your money is ready because you're going to be competing against others.
Well, is cash still king?
Absolutely. And if it's in a multiple offer situation, guarantee there's somebody with cash.
With cash.
Thanks for raising that point.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily he who has the best offer wins. It's also going to be a matter of who has the limited contingencies.
Uh-huh.
So you can actually be not in the best monetary, you know, purchase price position, but have less contingencies.
What do you mean by contingencies?
Well, for example, some people may get a contingent on attorney review, tighten your yeah. inspection period, mm-hmm. make things more attractive to the seller. Sometimes for a seller, an extra few thousand dollars isn't worth taking, you know, a higher price with an offer with contingencies
right.
versus a lower price with no or little contingencies.
You know, but you'll see articles, they say, you know, here are the rules for buying a home, you know, make sure that it's subject to attorney review or whatever. But, you know, in the real world, you may want to have something like that, but it may not fly.
Right. And honestly, if you're working with an experienced, knowledgeable real estate professional, they're going to guide you through
okay.
what's necessary and what's not and how to better present your offer. So listen to them. They know what they're doing.
Okay. And then the final one?
Work with that realtor.
You didn't write this, did you? No, but seriously.
Her name is.
Yeah, her name is. Her website address. Yeah.
You want to work with a professional that knows the marketplace that you're looking to purchase in.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times. There's so many reasons for it, Steve. If you're dealing with a local agent that knows all the other local agents, there's relationships that take place.
Mm-hmm.
If you're trying to purchase a home in a specific place and you're working with an agent who's not even familiar with the area and you're competing against a real local agent who knows the other agents, the agent who knows the other agents has a better chance of getting an offer through than the outside agent.
Mm-hmm.
It's just human nature.
Well, you know, there's an old saying that, you know, many people know the price of something, but the value of nothing. And it's not only, you know, about commission costs or whatever, which are obviously an important part of the formula for making your decision, but it's what you're getting in return for the money that you're paying. And I mean, I would agree with you. I think using a real estate professional, it's not my area. I don't spend my days in the real estate market knowing what communities are priced which way, what the general market's looking like, and helping me through the closing. I think that's invaluable. So that's my two cents, and you're not paying me for that answer. It's the truth.
Agree.
Yeah. Let's talk about one last thing, fake listing scams. I know you have some thoughts about this. We have about a minute left.
Yeah. You know, this was something I'd seen in the past, and now apparently it's come back. And what is this fake listing scam? I'll give you a real scenario. I had a listing. It was for sale. The property was empty. A scammer saw the information like on Zillow, hijacked it, put it on Craigslist, marketed it as a property that was for rent.
Oh, boy.
A would-be victim calls up that scammer. Scammer tells them, oh, you can walk by through the property. If you're interested in it, I'll send you the key. Send me a cashier's check.
Mm.
And note that the prices are always less than they should be.
Yeah, yeah.
In two cases, the potential person that was going to be scammed did their homework, called me, and found out that the house was not even available for rent.
That's crazy.
So be very, very careful. Make sure you know what you're, yeah. who you're dealing with.
And I think it's the too good to be true rule. You know, if the rent is just too low, there's a reason. There's got to be a reason.
Yeah, exactly. You shouldn't be sending money and then somebody.
Oh, and then a cashier's check sending money. Yeah. Forget that.
There's your first clue.
All right. My guest, Terry Story, 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker, located in Boca Raton, Florida. She can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. I'm back with Monish Prabhai. This is our part of our Great Investor Series. Monish began his investing career in 1999 and has been using the ideas and philosophies of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger ever since. Monish, so you are a person who invests using the value techniques. What does it mean to be a value investor?
Well, I mean, to be a value investor is, you know, investing is the art of laying out money today with the idea that you'll hopefully get more back in the future. And of course, if the future is not too distant and if the amount returned is multiples of what you put in, then that's wonderful. So value comes in many flavors. I mean, sometimes a stock that's really cheap can be a value buy, and sometimes a stock that's really cheap cannot be a value buy. Mm-hmm. And the reverse holds true as well, where things that appear expensive may be a bargain. So one has to really kind of peel the onion to truly understand the business and then truly understand the cash flows that business is likely to produce over the next several years. And for most businesses, we are unable to do that, which is perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. We don't need to figure it out for every business. But for a small sliver of businesses that may be within our circle of competence, we may be able to figure that out. And when there's a big distortion between price and what something is worth, that's when the likes of me will step in, and the rest of the time we'll just do nothing.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because that's my favorite part of your philosophy is this doing nothing. And I often say, unless you're a teenager, doing nothing is actually an active activity. So you don't really care so much about the whole market. You're just looking at individual companies.
Yeah, I have never particularly cared about the market. I mean, actually, when I was starting Prabhai Funds in 99, you know, the NASDAQ, about 9 months after it started, hit an all-time high. Mm-hmm. And then went on to lose 80% of its value.
Yeah.
And I actually understood in 99 that when I was looking at the valuations of many companies that broader markets were elevated. But we did really well because I've never been concerned about the broader market. We picked stocks that made sense. And actually what was happening in the 99, 2000, 2001, 2002 timeframe was that boring kind of brick and mortar companies got really cheap, while kind of sexy sizzle companies, technology companies, dot-coms, got really expensive. And so, you know, if you look at the day the NASDAQ peaked in March 2000, was the same day that Berkshire hit a multi-year low. I think the stock dropped to about 40,000. Mm-hmm. And both events happened on the same day. And it was almost like money was being sucked out of Berkshire Hathaway and being dumped into all these, you know, frothy NASDAQ stocks.
Yeah.
So for a value investor like me, even in that kind of frothy environment, there was a section of the market that was really cheap. And that's where I went looking. And that's what I've always done. You know, I don't think Jim Cramer has too many great quotes, but one of his quotes I like is there's always a bull market somewhere.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there is always companies that are mispriced and underpriced at all times. It can be a small number of companies or it can be a large number of companies, but there are always businesses that are trading well below where they should be trading.
So what about these days?
It's the exact same thing. I mean, I think in what I find in 2017 is I find very little to buy in the United States. If I look in the last 12 months, the only thing I've bought in the United States is airline stocks. You know, we bought Southwest Airlines in last summer. And I think about a little over a year ago, I bought an airline leasing company, AerCap. But I haven't found much in the U.S., but I have found a good number of things to buy in South Korea, and I found a good number of things to buy in India. Mm-hmm. And again, so like Charlie Munger says, is you go fishing where the fish are. So if I look at the Prabhai Funds portfolio today, one of the things that really surprises me is more than 70% of the portfolio today, out of the 560 million or something we have, is invested in businesses domiciled outside the U.S.
Wow.
It's in China, South Korea, India, Europe, etc. It's the largest percentage it's ever been since I started. And I think for the bulk of the period that Pabrai Fund has been around, our international investments were usually well under 25%, 20%. So there's been a significant change, and I can see it going even beyond 70%. And even when I look at the U.S. stocks, you know, the 30% that are domiciled in the U.S., I have companies like General Motors, which have very strong amounts of cash flow coming out of places like China. So even though that's a U.S. company, a lot of its cash flows come in from outside the U.S.
You know, I heard a quote from you, and this may have been a while ago, but you were saying that you didn't care to invest in China because in China there are three sets of books.
That's right.
The first set is for the government. The second set is for the wife. And the third set is for the mistress. So which set of books are you looking at in China?
Well, that is absolutely true. I think for most of the listeners of your show, I would say that probably best to leave China alone. Mm-hmm. Or if you're investing, then try to find a high quality, you know, mutual fund or index to go through. So I think in China, I just have one investment, and we did a lot of due diligence. So I think in this case, there is indeed one set of books and such. So that was that. I'll leave the company unmentioned, but you know, the government is a large shareholder in that business.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of market participants like to get in and out of stocks. And if you watch, you know, investment shows, you mentioned Jim Cramer, you know, there's always an idea for the day, and it's this idea of getting in and getting out. But Charlie Munger says that the big money is not made in the buying and selling of stocks. It's in the waiting. What do you mean? What is he waiting for?
Well, so I think one of the best examples, and this happened very recently with Charlie Munger, is he was recently mentioning how he read Barron's for 50 years from something like, you know, the 1950s to the early 2000s. And after 50 years of reading Barron's, he made one investment. He made an investment in 2002 in a company called Tenneco, you know, auto parts. Mm-hmm. And he put $10 million in 2002 into Tenneco. And a couple of years later, he bought the distressed bonds as well. But a couple of years later, when he sold that investment, it was $80 million that he collected. It was an 8X in 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then he took that $80 million and gave it to a very promising manager who was focusing on investing in Asia, a person named Li Lu. And that $80 million, I think my best guess is, it's sitting at around $500 million today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from 2002 to 2017, and actually if you go back, it's really going back to the 1950s, but in this 17-year period, Charlie Munger took two decisions. And those two decisions delivered a 50x return in the U.S. and in international markets. And so that's really what he's talking about. And he did the same thing with the Daily Journal, which is one of the public companies that he controls. Is the Daily Journal was sitting on a bunch of cash. And then in March of 2009, during the depths of the financial crisis, they bought Wells Fargo and U.S. Bank. And they pretty much bought Wells at the absolute bottom tick when it was, I think, around $10 a share. Mm-hmm. And that is today north of $50 a share.
Right,
so
right.
Inaction and patience are very important traits, but they need to be coupled with decisiveness and willingness to act in size. So it's an unusual kind of trait to have someone who's happy watching the paint dry, but then when all the ducks line up, you swing hard.
Well, I think the answer is in being able to recognize when the ducks are all lined up. That's the hard part.
Yeah, and actually that's also not hard if you just say, I'm only going to invest in complete no-brainers.
Yeah, well, that's true.
So that's the key, is that if you're not convinced you're looking at a no-brainer, take a pass.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's this quote from Pascal, all man's misery comes from his inability to sit in a room and do nothing. Would you say the same for money managers as well?
Yeah, I tweaked that quote a little bit. I say that all investment manager miseries stem from the inability to sit quietly in a room and do nothing. So yes, one of the best things that most investors and money managers can do is dramatically take down the activity.
But the exercise sounds very Victorian, very 19th century, because you said that the investment industry is set up the wrong way. It should be gentlemen or gentlewomen of leisure going about their daily tasks. And when the world is severely fearful, that is when they put their leisurely task aside and go to work. It sounds like an ideal way to live, but it must be harder than it sounds.
I mean, it is. I think temperament and patience, I think these are probably almost inherited traits, are very fundamental to being a great investor. And so, you know, to some extent, I think you have to be wired a certain way to be happy with that sort of a kind of approach to life. I mean, someone like Charlie Munger is very happy spending his time designing dorm buildings for the University of California, Santa Barbara, or, you know, reading esoteric books on science or global warming or whatever else. And he's perfectly fine with that taking up his days. And then, you know, when these aberrations show up in the stock market, he can, you know, very quickly act on those as well.
My guest is Monish Prabhai. He is an accomplished investor and, as you can see, is someone who thinks a lot about what he's doing. You know, Monish, a lot of people think that when entrepreneurs start businesses, that they take high risk, and that high risk is something that's very necessary in order to get a high return. But you say that's not really the fact. What is the fact?
Yeah, so actually it's a misnomer. You know, if you look at non-venture-backed businesses, entrepreneurs really are kind of like arbitrage players. You know, someone who's opening a Chinese restaurant is going to try to see if there are any other restaurants that might compete with him in the area. And if there are four of them, he'll probably try to look for another location. So entrepreneurs look for offering gaps and places where they can arbitrage. And arbitrage by its very nature is risk-free or nearly risk-free. And so entrepreneurs do everything in their power to minimize risk. And so what they're trying to do is low risk, high return, not high risk, high return. And that model for entrepreneurs is a really good model for investors. And, you know, this is the reason why Warren Buffett says, I'm a better investor because I'm a businessman. And I'm a better businessman because I'm an investor, because there's a huge cross-pollination in those two fields. And so it is a huge advantage if you've been an entrepreneur and, you know, started and grown a business, because the approach you've taken to achieve success there, a lot of those elements apply very directly for value investing.
Yeah. You mentioned in one of your talks that Bill Gates, when he started Microsoft, had very, very little capital actually invested. He really didn't put a lot at risk.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, if you're going to say someone is taking a lot of risk, that has to mean that they have the possibility of losing a lot of money. Well, someone like Bill Gates was a college dropout. So his value in the job market was, you know, just maybe barely above minimum wage. And then the total amount of money Microsoft took from the time it started pretty much till its IPO was probably less than $50,000. And even the proceeds in the IPO, the company didn't need that. So between the time it started and today, they've never taken in money. So everything's been generated internally. And so Microsoft, you cannot say, was a high-risk venture. It was a venture with high uncertainty. And that's what investors should look for. I mean, the key trait of an investment that is likely to do well is one that exhibits low risk coupled with high uncertainty. Because when you have high uncertainty, markets hate that. And they will typically underprice companies with a lot of uncertainty. So if you look at a, let's say, if you look at a company like, let's say, ADP, which processes payrolls, you know, if you just pull up the stock chart or you look up the dividend history or the earnings history of ADP, what you'll find is it's like clockwork. It just continues to go up almost nonstop for 50, 60 years. That type of a business is a very low uncertainty business. And a low uncertainty business like that is not going to be underpriced.
Yeah.
What you want to look for is a business with very high uncertainty. And there you can occasionally get extreme mispricing, and that's the time to step in, like Charlie did with Tenneco. I mean, the stock dropped to a dollar. I think he sold it for $15, but then it went to $55 after that.
Yeah.
So that's really what you want to do.
Again, a reason why I have Monish Prabhai with us. He is in our great investor series. Monish, thank you for taking your valuable time to join us today.
Always a pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
To find out more about Monish, to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. This week on the On the Money Minute, allocating your assets during retirement. Hi, this is Steve Pomerantz with today's On the Money Minute. In the event that your retirement income won't cover your retirement expenses, many people turn to their portfolios to make up the difference. Even if you're a person who has saved enough, your portfolio will require regular attention if it's to help support the lifestyle you want. Asset allocation is part of the process. The goal here is to determine the optimal allocation prior to the selection of individual assets. Put a different way, putting your money into various types of assets allows you to achieve your financial goals and take advantage of risk reduction. It helps you to avoid being overweighted in certain classes of assets and underweighted in others. After all, that's the bottom line with asset allocation. I'm Steve Pomerantz. To hear more on the Money Minutes, plus Steve's weekly radio show, go to stevepomerantz.com. You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.